Welcome to 2819. I'm Sandra Dimas.
And I'm Brian Rollenbacher.
And we have a fun show for you today. Pretty wild, a bunch of different topics.
That's right. We're going to hear from philosopher and theologian Ken Samples as he talks about the difference between science and scientism.
Yeah, that's a kind of a common question that we get. We're also going to hear from RZIM's Stuart McAllister, and he's going to be talking about revolution, the French Revolution specifically.
Versus the American Revolution. So we're going to kind of see how those were different and what does that mean for today's culture. So should be really good. First up, those culture talk. Sandra's going to be talking with biochemist Fuzzel Rana about something kind of controversial, but maybe very tasty. And that's the Chickenosaurus.
Yes, which Brian keeps calling dino nuggets, and it's not.
I love dino nuggets.
Yes, me too.
But let's check that out.
Welcome to Culture Talk, where we discuss culturally relevant topics that you can use to start conversations about your faith. I'm joined today with biochemist Fuzzel Rana. Thank you for joining us, Fuzz.
Sandra, thanks for having me.
We are going to talk about something called the Chickenosaurus. So first, this question came in to us from Kevin C., and it came in through Facebook. So he's asking about the Chickenosaurus, but before we dive into his specific question, what is a Chickenosaurus? It sounds fun.
Well, it is fun, and it doesn't actually exist yet, but there are many scientists who hope that one day they can actually create a creature called a Chickenosaurus, which would be a chicken that has dinosaur-like features.
So like dino nuggets, right?
That's right, dino nuggets, yeah. But everybody has seen, or at least is familiar with, Jurassic Park and Jurassic World, the idea that scientists are using ancient DNA from dinosaurs to try to clone dinosaurs, resurrect them from extinction. Well, this is not really technically feasible. There's no way that that's ever going to happen. But there are scientists who think that maybe one day they can actually resurrect dinosaurs from extinction by essentially reversing the evolutionary process. There's many in the scientific community who think birds have evolved from dinosaurs. So their idea is that could we take a bird and reverse evolve it back to its ancestral state, back to a dinosaur-like state? And everybody is focusing on the chicken because we know a whole lot about chicken biology because of the poultry industry. So scientists are trying to create this creature called a Chickenosaurus.
So we're talking about reverse engineering, right?
Yeah, although the term is reverse evolution.
Reverse evolution.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think for a layperson, that's what we hear in movies and stuff. And what we think about, like for something like Jurassic World, where they reverse evolution, something that already exists to make something they shouldn't bring back, I think. But if reverse evolution, and this was the question from Kevin, if reverse evolution appears to work, what plausible non-evolutionary explanation might there be?
Yeah, and as I mentioned, many people in the scientific community think that birds have evolved from dinosaurs. And part of that evidence is the shared anatomical features that birds and dinosaurs have, with the assumption that those shared features must reflect an evolutionary history. And so it's on that basis that, again, people are trying to, again, reverse evolve birds into dinosaurs. And so people are arguing that if we can actually do that, then doesn't that mean there's evidence for evolution? But from a creation model perspective, we would see shared features as not reflecting common descent, but common design, where a creator is employing similar design elements to create both birds and dinosaurs. And in order to create these creatures with similar design elements, but also that have distinct features, they share an embryologically a process of embryological development, but there's also uniquenesses in that process as well. And so what scientists are doing is they're manipulating essentially the developmental process, calling it reverse evolution, but you could just simply see it as manipulating development to try to get birds to be dinosaur-like.
So you talked about the RTB, or the reasons to believe creation model, and what we would kind of expect that from attempts. Can you explain a little bit more about how attempts to reverse evolution and create something like a Chickenosaurus, how that fits within our model and what we would expect to see as a result of these attempts?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the idea that scientists may actually reverse evolve dinosaurs from birds, quote unquote, is actually possible. But again, I don't see this as reflecting an evolutionary history, but rather I see this as essentially manipulating the developmental process to make a bird develop in a way that looks more like a reptile or a dinosaur than like a bird. And this is possible because of the shared biological features that we have. So yeah, indeed, it is something that somebody could point to as evidence for evolution, but it doesn't mean that a creation model perspective can't account for the creation of a chickenosaurus.
Describe a little bit more on how we point to a creator when we talk about these shared systems.
Yeah, well, you know, if you think about an architect, for example, architects typically have a design style that they employ. And many times we'll use those same design elements to create very different types of buildings. It's part of their style, it's part of their flair, where they utilize form, but they can modify that form in various ways to create different types of functional features within the architectural design. And so we would see organisms in that same way, that the creator is employing the same kind of design elements. And so those shared design elements reflect, in a sense, that creator's style or artistry, but then also that those design elements have the robustness that they can be varied in such a way to create a wide range of different types of functional features.
So how would you, as someone who unfortunately hasn't seen any of the Jurassic Park films, but aware enough of the content and what they've created, how would you use this topic as a conversation starter to talk about your faith?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, first of all, this idea of dinosaurs fascinates so many people. The idea of maybe one day experiencing or encountering a real life dinosaur is something that many people dream about, you know, and you know, the idea of creating a chicken that's dinosaur-like is so bizarre and fun that these are really non-threatening ways to talk about things that people are likely to be interested in, but then to be able to use that as a really nice segue into something that's more spiritually meaningful and significant. And so there's so many different hooks, you know, when it comes to this topic that can lead us to really big questions about how do we really explain where life comes from? And is the evolutionary paradigm the only explanation, or could it be that a creator was somehow involved? And if so, how?
Yeah. Well, I think that would be a fun conversation to sit in, especially with the kid, like talk about what's your favorite dinosaur, right? You know, and then dive into this conversation about design features and God. So yeah, thank you so much for that, Fuzz. Now, if people want to read a little bit more about this topic, they can find your article on reasons.org, and it is called The Creation Evolution Controversy in Jurassic World.
Now it's time for RTB 101, where we discuss practical questions to equip you to share your faith more effectively. And here to help me talk about a very important worldview question is my colleague, philosopher and theologian, Kenneth Samples. Welcome back, Ken.
Hi, Krista.
Glad to have you here. You know, we are both theologians, but we work with a lot of scientists and reasons to believe. We like to explore that area of overlap between the latest scientific discoveries and what we read in the scriptures. Now, I'm sure that many in our culture kind of find our position a little odd. You know, they might be thinking, how can you affirm the advances of scientific discovery on the one hand and be a historic Christian on the other hand? Maybe we could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I find what's very helpful for me, and I think it's helpful when I share it with others, Krista, is Christians believe in two books. Now, it's not the two books like you would have in Islam, where you'd have the Quran and the Bible, and it's not like Mormonism, where you have the Book of Mormon and the Bible. Rather, we have two books, the Book of Nature, which is a figurative book, And then we have the literal book of scripture. So Christians through the centuries, and this idea of two books, it precedes even St. Augustine. So it's pretty early in church history that there's the book of nature that God authored, and there's the book of scripture that God authored. And when we interpret those two books, the data we would get from the natural sciences or from history or philosophy, and we compare that to scripture, if we interpret them properly, God speaks, and he speaks consistently. And so RTB, Reasons to Believe, has adopted that fundamental Christian idea of the two books approach to revelation.
So we're really trying to kind of find this third way of not merely looking at the science or not merely looking at the Bible, but really trying to see how both of these can reveal the Creator. So we have a high view of science. Now, I'm hearing more and more on my social media feeds about a term called scientism. And that's a little bit of a new term for me. And it seems like in the context, it's a little different than just being an advocate for good science, which is what we do at Reasons to Believe. So maybe you can help me understand this term scientism. Is there a basic definition we could discuss?
Yeah, that's a very important point you're making there. So let's start with science. Science is really a practice. It is observing the natural world and drawing information. Scientists develop hypotheses, and they test these models to see if they are confirmed. And so science is then largely a practice of gaining knowledge and understanding of the natural world. Scientism is a broad-based philosophy. Scientism is not merely a practice. Scientism, for example, would say that the natural world is all there is. I mean, that's a philosophical statement. And they would often say, depending on whether you have kind of a hard or soft scientism, a hard scientism would say the only way you can get real knowledge and truth is through science. A soft scientism would say the best way to get knowledge is through science. See, whereas at RTB, we believe we can get knowledge through science, but we also believe that knowledge and information and truth comes through other venues, such as revelation, such as philosophy. So the difference is scientism is a secular philosophy of life. Science is a practice of understanding the natural world.
That's really helpful. And so it kind of almost sounds like you're taking science as a study of the natural world and then turning it more into a worldview. You're applying it to other things, the nature of reality and what's real and what's not. Would that be a way of thinking about it?
Yeah, no, that's right on target. I mean, if you listen to Richard Dawkins, or if you listen to, often very controversial and outspoken atheists, they will sometimes, Stephen Hawking is a good example. They will tell you, for example, that the material world is all there is. Now, they don't know that. There's nothing in nature that tells you the material world is all there is. Or they'll say statements like the absolute determiner of truth comes through experimental science. But the problem is experimental science doesn't tell you that. So it is a philosophy, and it extends much further than just your standard scientific investigation of the natural world.
Well, that sparks my thinking back a little bit historically, because some would say, you know, the scientific revolution that happened with Galileo turned our attention away from the Bible to scrutinizing nature, you know, that we've advanced past looking at for divine revelation, for information about the natural world. And I know that many people in our culture have a concern that about whether or not Christians can even be a responsible scientist, you know, if they're a Christian. Do scientists need to buy into scientism as a worldview in order to do good science? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I would say no. There are many people that are outstanding scientists who don't happen to buy the worldview of scientism. I mean, you mentioned Galileo. Galileo was a very conservative Roman Catholic, and he had a high view of scripture. He had a high view of truth that can be discovered through the sciences. So I would say that not only can you be a good scientist and not buy into the secular worldview of scientism, but that scientism has all kinds of inherent problems and difficulties. I mean, again, nothing in science tells you the natural world is all there is. And you cannot get out of an experiment that you should only trust knowledge that comes through an experiment. So there are some incredibly good scientists who don't embrace scientism, but rather believe that there is knowledge available in theology, in philosophy, in the social sciences.
When we're talking to our non-Christian friends, I'm trying to kind of think of, you know, what their pushback might be. And one of the things that sort of comes to me is that, well, doesn't adopting a Christian worldview actually stifle science? I mean, it's almost like scientism and Christianity, couldn't they be seen as worldview competitors? Because science is helping us overcome world hunger and bring about innovations to eliminate disease through medical research. Doesn't scientism actually offer a better hope than Christianity about improving our quality of life?
Well, the first thing I would say is that the study of the natural sciences is one of the most incredible enterprises that human beings have been able to accomplish. And so I think Christians that have a real sincere respect for science. Science and technology has brought a lot of good to humanity, extended our life span, etc. However, Christianity was the worldview that produced science. I mean, science and scientific ideas kind of sparkled at different places through the centuries, the Greeks, the Romans, etc. But the scientific revolution took place in the middle of the 1600s, and it took place in Christian Europe. So the vast majority of the early scientists were Christian. And Krista, the presuppositions, that is, these philosophical ideas that go into the practice of science, things like there's a real world out there, I can trust my cognitive faculties and sensory organs, math and logic are valid, there's real order in the world. All of these presuppositions fit really well with what I would call a Judeo-Christian or biblical worldview. So you can't do science without adopting a worldview. And I think the worldview that best fits is Christianity, which produced it in the beginning.
Very good. Very thoughtful discussion. Thank you for your help, Ken, in thinking that through. And I do want to encourage all of our viewers to go check out Ken's blog. It's called Reflections, and you can access that by going to the reasons.org website and search for Reflections.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink, and welcome again to Give and Take, the segment of our show where we explore important scientific ideas and how they help you be more confident in the truth of Christianity. I'm joined again by Stuart McAllister, and we're going to continue our discussion on freedom, looking at how different countries have pursued freedom. Stuart, it's good to have you back.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You have just enjoyed working with you and Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. You're a global support specialist, if I remember correctly.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, I know we've done some work down in Peru, helping set up ministries down there, spreading the gospel to what's going on. And, right. You know, as we interact with different countries, different countries just look at freedom differently. So kind of, you know, basically, as you would give me a 20-second version, what is freedom?
Well, I think freedom is the ability to do what we need to do. So being set free from things. And for most people, they define freedom in negative terms. I'm free from something, and therefore I need to be free from authority or from chains or bind. But Isaiah Berlin adds into that that freedom has two elements to it. Negative freedom is to be free from. Positive freedom, which is to be free for, and those must be confined. So to truly be free, I must be set free from those things, those conditions that bind me, and I must be able to do the things that I'm free for. Mm-hmm. And that's what freedom would be in that direction.
And so, you know, in talking with you, it seems like different countries have pursued freedom differently. I know you've indicated that, you know, the French Revolution and the American Revolution are an example of how different countries have pursued freedom. Flesh that out a little bit for us.
I think modern history has really been shaped by, there are probably four revolutions that have affected us. In one way, the French, the American, the Bolshevik, and now the sexual revolution. But let's go to those two at the moment. The key issue there was that for the French, they were being set free from the king and the church. So there was a very anti-authoritarian dimension. It was a much more egalitarian liberty fraternity. In America, they were being set free from the British authority, but the church was still a component. God was central in the American story. So there was religious liberty. There was not to be state religion. They were very, very clear of the distinction between the government and state. But the church, but there's still freedom for. Whereas in the French picture, there was freedom from, there wasn't freedom for. So America and the French revolutions had two very different trajectories, and that has played out over time in conceptions of freedom.
So in the French Revolution, it's more a removing of authority over so that the people could presumably do what,
well,
or
it,
be free to do how they
want to
do.
It's a removing of one kind of authority and replacing it. So they obviously wanted authority, but what played out, of course, in the French Revolution was that many of the revolutionaries very shortly ended up themselves going under the guillotine, and they were replaced by Napoleon, the emperor. So the French trajectory hasn't been, now they've got the you know, the new republics and so forth. But America was caught between, because Jefferson and others were torn between which model should America be? Because he had a lot of deistic ideas. There was a God, but not necessarily the God of scripture, but he had a God in his mind that was real. He believed in a moral authority, and he believed that was important to freedom and liberty. But not the French model would not allow for that.
Well, I think if I remember correctly, the American Revolution, where we removed ourselves from British authority, there was a time span before the current form of government we have is
well,
set up. Correct?
That was a key experience, because just like the children of Israel coming out of Egypt, who were a rabble and taken into the and had been set free, but spent half the early days trying to go back to Egypt and wanted to go back until they were given worship and the law and a constitution. America, the same thing, the Declaration of Independence, 1776, America was free. But then for the next 13 years or so, there was, till 1789, there was a lot of disorder, chaos. Where did authority lie? What was the binding units? And that led to the formation of the constitution. So that was the setting free negative freedom. Positive freedom was a covenantal structure in which freedom was then directed towards a purpose.
Well, and it seems very much, even in the way the Constitution was set up, is recognizing there needs to be some authority, but it was very much limited authority to try and keep tyranny from coming back.
Yeah,
in,
I mean,
if you
America,
will.
Because America was structured based on lessons of trying to make sure that power was diversely located and could be accountable in different ways. And that's a very healthy idea. But what we're having in the modern world now is, in our modern life, we have moved from the authority of God through the authority of the nation to the authority of the self. Mm. And we remove God, we remove nation, and basically the only authority that we accept for many people is my own authority. I have the absolute supreme right to self-definition. But that's not freedom, that's bondage, because it leads to anarchy. If you have 350 million Americans, or 330 million, whatever the number is, all doing that which is right in their own eyes, and then upset by someone who does that which is right in their eyes that you don't like, you have a massive problem for community, for relationship, for success, and I would say even for the survival of the country.
Well, that's an interesting idea there, because in essence, it sounds like with a properly set up authority where there's a purpose and direction where you're going, that kind of provides a cohesion or a purpose that allows you to experience what freedom was designed to do. Well, it allows you to do what you're intended, as opposed to just fighting about who's going to be in control, if you will.
Anybody who's a parent knows you need good authority.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, if you just basically let the kids, and some people do this, get on, your house is going to be anarchy, your carpets are going to be a mess, food is not going to be ate, places will become chaos. You need a sheriff in town, not because we just like order for order's sake, but because we need structure, good authority. Bad authority doesn't mean having no authority. Mm-hmm. Bad authority should be answered by good authority.
You know, it's an interesting illustration because, you know, I've tried to teach my kids how to obey and be responsible and grow. And one of the things that I appreciate about that is that, you know, when we go camping, it's like, you know, there's no food in the tent. You don't play around the tent, because the reality of it is if our tent goes down, we don't have any place to stay that
night.
But, you know, it also works out that when we go camping, we can go to Glacier where there are bears around. And because they've developed some structure and discipline there, we can go to these remarkable places that would be dangerous if they didn't have the basic structure and responsibility in place. And it sounds like that plays out in the country as well, that if there's not a basic structure.
It does in all of life, because what we're teaching, we're infantilizing people. Because what we're teaching is that authority and structure, rules and regulations, to some degree are common to all practices of life, mm-hmm. whether you're driving on the highway, whether you're camping out with your friends, or whether you're piloting an aircraft. You've got to do things according to certain procedures and ways. But this infantile desire to be removed from all authority, any moral restraints, mm-hmm. is basically the idolatry of the human heart, who thinks that I don't want to live under God, I want to be God.
It's just, I remember one of the times we were down in Peru driving around, and Peru has very different driving structure than we do.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, it's just everybody's trying to get where they want to go. Whereas you go out and drive on U.S. roads, and because there's structure, you've got freedom to move around. You know, again, it's just kind of a microcosm of what you're talking about.
Martin Luther famously said, you know, about the fish being free in water, but it's not free when you put it on land. As your child who buys the first goldfish finds out, when they want to take the goldfish out the tank and play around with the thing, it doesn't do very well when it's played with on the carpet outside its environment. We as human beings need structure, and these are not to constrain us, they're to guide us, they're to facilitate what it means to truly be human. So to be really free is to understand God's order, God's world, and how God's world works, to live in it in alignment with his purpose, and that way we can truly be free.
Well, thanks very much, Stuart. I appreciate your comments today. You know, we often think of freedom as the ability to do whatever we want with no constraints. But the reality of it is we're truly free when we're properly under authority, so that we're free to do what we're designed to be. You know, I would encourage you to go to rzim.org, look for Stuart McAllister's homepage. You'll get access to a lot of resources that will help you understand freedom and how we operate within the design that God has given us, so that we have the freedom to share his gospel, the freedom to be who we are, the freedom to point other people to the God who created everything.
That does it for us this week on 2819. We hope you enjoyed this episode and it helps equip you to share your faith with confidence and compassion.
And we hope that you'll connect with us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are at 2819 Show.
Also, if you'd like the audio version, you can get us on most major podcast services. But also, we're curious, let us know, where do you listen to the podcast? And if there's a service that we're not on, drop that in the comments. We'll look into it. No promises, though.
Yeah. Also, if you have an Echo, you can say, "Hey, Alexa, play Reasons to Believe podcast." And guess what? We'll show up.
Well, that is it for us this week, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.